9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
President Biden prepares to announce his re-election bid. Plus, Credit Suisse investors challenge Switzerland's $17 billion bond write-down, and why activist investors are laying down their arms in the battle for boardroom control.
We're kind of in a position where there's still a lot of volatility out there in the market. And if you're an activist and also on the company side, you'd prefer to not spend all this money and have a really nasty fight play out.
It's Friday, April 21st. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. And here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. President Biden is planning to announce his re-election bid in a video announcement as early as next week, according to people familiar with those plans. That announcement has been long expected, but aides said there had been little urgency to make it official, given the lack of a serious Democratic challenger and what they see as a chaotic Republican field. Biden is facing sagging approval ratings and public concern about his age and fitness for office. Already the oldest president in U.S. history, Biden would be 86 at the end of a second term. Meanwhile, a new Wall Street Journal poll has found that Donald Trump has gained command over the GOP presidential nominating race among likely Republican primary voters. Trump trailed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in a prior poll in December, but now leads him by 13 percentage points in a hypothetical head-to-head matchup. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg has told employees that he won't rule out future layoffs after the company announced plans to part ways with nearly a quarter of its workforce in a series of announcements since November. We are exclusively reporting that Zuckerberg gave that news to employees yesterday, just a day after Meta completed its latest round of job cuts, which involved 4,000 workers. Journal technology reporter Sam Schechner.
The company has been reeling from these rounds of cuts, and the latest ones hit its tech teams, engineers, the sort of core of what Meta does. And employees took it maybe not that well. There has been complaints internally from some of the people that my colleagues and I have spoken with that top employees, top executives aren't really taking full accountability for the missteps that led to the need for these cuts. And you know, people tried to call Mark Zuckerberg out on that in yesterday's Q&A.
You say the missteps that led to the need for these cuts. What exactly are they pointing to?
Mark Zuckerberg himself has said that during the pandemic, the company overhired. They thought that some of the changes in consumer behavior that we saw in that period when everyone was going online would be permanent. And it turned out to not be the case. And, you know, companies didn't necessarily foresee the wave of inflation or the macroeconomic picture deteriorating quite so quickly. And they were hiring in an era of free money, and interest rates are now much higher. So employees think that's what a CEO is for. And why did you go so far towards big bets like the metaverse and huge investments only to have investors say, hey, you need to cut costs, and then turn around and slash nearly a quarter of your workforce?
That was Wall Street Journal technology reporter Sam Schechner. Credit Suisse bondholders have launched a legal case in Switzerland against regulators' decision to write down the securities as part of the troubled bank's rescue by UBS last month. That move stunned markets, given that typically bank shares would have been written down entirely before creditors would have to take losses. Journal finance reporter Margot Patrick says that bondholders of some $5 billion of Credit Suisse's canceled debt now want that write-down revoked or amended, arguing that it was disproportionately punitive to them and violated their property rights.
So when Switzerland took this action, they took the risk that the international investment community would really take offense to this, because a reason that, you know, investors choose to put their money into a country or to a country's companies is because they trust the rule of law and because they don't expect surprises. So it's raised the prospect of investors could try to boycott Switzerland, refuse to buy bonds from its banks, or refuse to buy government bonds. There's pressures that can be exerted, and not least these legal pressures that we're seeing now. Switzerland has to be sure that they keep their reputation as a trustworthy country where investors can put their money with confidence.
America's biggest banks and a number of its smaller Main Street lenders reported earnings this week. There weren't many bombshell revelations among the results, but following recent turmoil in the banking sector, even small signs of trouble are being closely watched. Journal finance editor Alex Frangos has been looking for takeaways among this week's results, and he joins me now to crunch the numbers. Alex, just from 30,000 feet, can we sort of say that no news, or at least no news that the sky is falling in the banking sector, is kind of the same now as good news?
Yeah, basically things weren't worse than people expected. So we did see quite a lot of customers pull deposits from mid and small sized banks last quarter when the Silicon Valley Bank blow up was happening. We saw a lot of deposits go to some of the big banks like JP Morgan, but the size of those flows weren't any bigger than people expected. And they were the size that investors very much felt that the banks can handle for now. We've also had a reduction in bond yields, which helps these banks as well, because a lot of them were holding bonds that had lost value because of the rising yields. So put that all together, you know, a month after Silicon Valley Bank went under and caused a real panic, people are feeling, you know, some cautious sense of calm.
And I mean, how are investors and crucially depositors, do you think, interpreting those results?
Investors definitely saw, you know, we saw some bank shares go up quite a bit this week on the idea that things weren't getting worse. So it was, again, kind of a cautious optimism that maybe what felt very much last month like a real panic and a real problem at the heart of the financial system maybe has been contained for now. I think regular depositors, one thing we saw was that the outflows that were happening in the early part of the year slowed down at a lot of these banks. And so that's a sign that depositors were getting a little bit more comfortable with the idea that, okay, maybe my money is safe. Look, the Fed did some major, major interventions here to reassure the confidence in the banking system. And, you know, the fact that things didn't get worse after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, we didn't see the cascade that everyone was worrying about, at least we haven't yet, that's gotten people feeling more comfortable. The other thing is that a lot of these banks are finally offering much higher interest rates on deposits and CDs. When that happens, you think, well, I'll leave my money here. I'm making money doing nothing. So people feel more comfortable.
You mentioned the effect of federal interventions lately. We are reporting that the Federal Reserve may close a loophole that allows some mid-sized banks to effectively mask some of their securities losses, which they determined to be a contributing factor in the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. What does that tell us?
It tells us that the Fed officials want to reassure the system and fix what many see as, you know, a glaring loophole. Basically, in 2018, 2019, the federal government relaxed some post-financial crisis rules for medium and small-sized banks, basically said, you don't have to count these losses in, you know, securities, basically bonds that have lost value. You don't have to count them against your capital ratios, which are the size of the buffers that protect them in case something goes wrong. And that's exactly what happened with Silicon Valley Bank. And so it's sort of a, look, this thing just happened. Let's fix it.
So we can't rest on our laurels. There's more to do to tighten up how this sector operates.
Yeah, I mean, I think the history of financial regulation is it gets tighter and then people's memories fade and the regulations loosen and then there's a crisis and then people say, let's tighten them up again. And we're in the let's tighten it up phase again.
That was Wall Street Journal finance editor Alex Frangos. Alex, thanks as always for stopping by.
Thank you.
Coming up, it was supposed to be a year for high-profile proxy fights at companies from Disney to Salesforce. But instead of fighting, activist investors are largely chilling out. We'll look at why and get the rest of the day's news after the break.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune in to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Each week, we bring you stock market outlooks, macroeconomic updates, and investment strategies that can help you succeed. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience about how they navigate uncertain markets. Prepare to be engaged, enlightened, and entertained by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.
activist shareholders are showing more bark than bite. That is one early takeaway from the 2023 proxy season in the U.S. so far, in which only one activist investor's bid for board representation has made it all the way to a shareholder vote. So why exactly are activists laying down their arms in their battles for boardroom control? Here with the answers is Wall Street Journal shareholder activism reporter Lauren Thomas. Lauren, I feel like just a few months ago, we had you on the show talking about activist swarms that were targeting a number of top companies. What's going on? Why has there been kind of a reversal in this trend?
Yes, exactly. I know. And I remember that conversation. And at the time, by the way, that was definitely the case, right? We had a few very high profile situations. One played out at Disney, one played out at Salesforce. Bath and Body Works also at one point had an activist. So these were some big names and in some instances, mega cap companies where activists did pile in. And there was a point in time just earlier this year when we thought some of these more high profile situations were going to go all the way to a vote. So again, what exactly does that mean? You know, an activist shows up, they'll nominate, whether it's just one person or a slate of director candidates that they want to see on the ballot, ultimately on that company's board, and then that will go to a vote. And those votes oftentimes take place over the summer months. So again, we were gearing up for some of these earlier this year. And what transpired? Well, in most of these situations, the activists have since backed down. And in some cases, they will strike a settlement agreement with the company where they will get one or two board seats, or they'll have some sort of representation and then walk away. But in some of these situations, they just walked away. And I think what we're getting at here is we're kind of in a position where there's still a lot of volatility out there in the market. And if you're an activist and also on the company side, you'd prefer to not spend all this money and have a really nasty fight play out in the public's purview. So yeah, to your point, you know, the numbers, when we look at where we're at so far this proxy season, they're really low in what we've seen actually go all the way to a vote.
Got it. So is it too much of a jump to say it's some sort of turmoil in the markets, broader economic uncertainty that is leading some activist investors to just say, "Ah, well, let's pick this up another time"?
Yeah, well, I think it's a bit of both. And you can look at it again from both the company's perspective and from the activist's perspective. Again, I think activists, these hedge funds, are, you know, they're certainly investing money in the market and there are opportunistic bets to be made. What I heard from a number of advisors is you are seeing a more conservative approach, you know, from the hedge fund activist standpoint. So I think that's how they're thinking about this. Now, on the flip side, companies are trying to be proactive as possible, I think, because they knew, again, when I was talking to folks late last year, everyone thought that this was going to be a really busy activist season with some really high profile, heated fights. And so I think companies late last year were trying to do as much as they could to get ahead of that. And so maybe that was replacing a director or two on the board that they knew was going to be particularly vulnerable for an attack. Or maybe that was, you know, enacting layoffs before an activist could show up and say, hey, you need to cut costs or you need to lay people off. So I do think that we saw a lot of proactive moves from companies. And then on the flip side, yeah, I think some activists are sitting back and, you know, it's probably best to just sit tight rather than to make a really risky bet right now that ends up going south.
And then what does this mean for companies and for boards? Can they breathe easier now?
Well, I think it's not necessarily that it's easier. There's still activity, and I don't think by any means companies can just sit back. But I do think it's just this really interesting dynamic where we thought activists had all this power on their side and they were gearing up to use that. But ultimately, and what the data has shown us thus far is it's been a lot quieter than we expected. I do think it'll still be an interesting, you know, back half of the year. And some companies have their nomination windows open up after the summer months. So I do still think we could see some activity later this year. I think everyone's just looking for certainty at the end of the day and where stocks are headed.
That was Wall Street Journal shareholder activism reporter Lauren Thomas. Lauren, thanks.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
In other news that's moving the world today, it is deadline day for the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on a closely watched abortion pill case. Justices gave themselves until today to decide whether to preserve access to the widely used medication mifepristone after lower courts imposed significant limits on the drug. Those restrictions are set to go into effect at the end of the day today, absent Supreme Court intervention. The case is the court's first major test on abortion since it eliminated the constitutional right to the procedure last year. And U.S. home prices in March posted their biggest annual decline in 11 years. That is according to the National Association of Realtors, which said that the national median existing home price dropped 0.9% last month from a year earlier, marking the biggest year-over-year price drop since January 2012. U.S. home sales also fell 22% in March compared to a year earlier, as higher mortgage rates squashed momentum from the previous month. Sales have now slid for the 13th time in the previous 14 months, a decline that doesn't bode well for the spring season, which is usually the most active time for home sales. And finally, home prices may be declining in some parts of the United States, but in other parts of the country, especially where jobs are being created, those prices are continuing to rise amid unusually low inventory. And amid continued high interest rates and the looming prospect of a recession in the next year, that is compounding the stress that surrounds perhaps the most important purchase that many people ever make. Thankfully, our sister podcast, Your Money Briefing, has been going deep this month on how to buy a home in the current market. And my colleague J.R. Whalen is here to give us a taste of today's latest episode in their special series, Under Contract. J.R., the home buying route was already a minefield before you toss in some of this year's added stressors. There are really a lot of things to juggle here.
Yeah, there really are, Luke. You know, so many details in this process. There's a blizzard of numbers, a blizzard of responsibility, all the phone calls, all the dealing with the agent, all the trying to get the right mortgage rate. And it's easy for people to make mistakes that not only are frustrating, but they can derail the entire home buying process.
Obviously, this is stressful anecdotally, as anyone who's purchased a home can attest to, but there's more to it than that even, right?
Yeah, you know, this is a real thing, Luke. In fact, we talked to a financial psychologist on the show who explains to us how the brain responds to pressure like this, pressure to buy a home and everything that's on the line, being able to expand your family, being able to establish credit if you can get a mortgage and buy a home, what that means down the line. The other thing is that we hear a lot about the two sides of the brain, the emotional side and the analytical side. That comes into play here. And we speak to a real estate professional who, when she takes people to look at homes, the first thing she tells them is the danger of letting emotion and biases get in the way of their judgment when running the numbers and doing analysis for something that can really unlock the future for your life.
JR, I think we got to rebrand Your Money Briefing to Your Brain on Money.
There you go. Okay. I really like that.
You can catch new episodes of Under Contract every Friday this month on our Your Money Briefing podcast with host J.R. Whalen. J.R., thanks for stopping by and happy Friday.
Luke, thanks for having me.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.